Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everyone. Okay, so now we've finished the original cycle of Majjhima Nikaya suttas that I had designed five years ago. So now we can just go through pretty much starting from the beginning and taking the suttas that I didn't cover. We won't take all of them. Some of them are not of great interest, but we'll take the more important ones. And so we start with sutta number 3 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Dhamma Dayada Sutta. The word Dayada means an heir, one who inherits something. And this is Dhamma Dayada, which means heirs in the Dhamma. And generally, it seems to me that the compilers of the middle-length discourses made it a special point to include, at least in the first 10 suttas, suttas that they considered especially important. And so in a country like Sri Lanka, it's said that if a monk is not going to study the whole Majjhima Nikaya, he should at least be familiar with the first 10 suttas in that collection. Okay, so this sutta begins when the Buddha is living in Savatthi at Jeta's Grove. And then the Buddha addresses the monks, and he says, "Monks, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things." And then he elaborates on this, and he says, "Out of compassion for you," says Anukampang Upadhyaya, "I think, how shall my disciples be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things?" Okay, so we have these two concepts here which are being played off one against the other. One is that of being an heir of Dhamma, and the other is that of being an heir in material things. Then the commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya, this is the 5th century commentary, gives an interesting breakdown or analysis of these two terms. It says each of these can be taken in two ways, in two senses. One is what is called, he uses an expression that means something like the literal sense or the ultimate sense of the expression. And the other is something like the figurative sense or the metaphorical sense. And so in the ultimate sense, what is meant by being an heir of the Dhamma? So the ultimate sense of being an heir of the Dhamma is to attain one of the 4 stages of enlightenment, the 4 stages of liberation. We've gone through these before. I don't have to take them in detail now. These are the stages of stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arhatship, and attaining nibbana, ultimate liberation. So the Buddha's intention or purpose is for his disciples to achieve these benefits. Like, this is the inheritance or the legacy that the Buddha passes on to his disciples. Okay, then what is meant by being an heir to the Dhamma in, we call this the relative sense or metaphorical sense? This means that one accepts the teachings and practices taught by the Buddha, and when one undertakes these practices, one does so with the intention of using them in order to achieve liberation. So many people are not yet developed enough to realistically have the chance of attaining one of the 4 stages of enlightenment, but they undertake any kind of practices. It can even be simply going for refuge, taking the 5 precepts, and one does so dedicating that practice to the goal of liberation. But one can practice dana, generosity. Again, one dedicates that to the aim of liberation. Or one practices some kind of meditation or one study of the texts, and one does so with the aim of gaining liberation. And so even if one receives the Buddha's teaching and one practices it with that aim of liberation, then one is still, in a sense, an heir to the Dhamma. But to achieve the ultimate inheritance means to achieve the goal of one of the four stages of awakening, or to attain nirvana. Okay, then what is meant by this expression, Amisa Dayada? The word Amisa, I don't know the original sense of it, but it comes to take on the sense of anything that's kind of material, worldly, carnal. I think the original meaning might have been bait. In fact, it's used in that sense in Pali texts as the bait that a fisherman uses for catching fish. The bait is called Amisa. Okay, and so the literal sense of being an heir to material things means to acquire material possessions. And this has a special meaning within the Buddha's teaching, because in this sense it's being used with reference to monastic persons who receive as gifts from the lay community, they receive the basic material means of support. They receive offerings of food, robes, temples and monasteries, help with medicines and other things that they need to lead their life. And all of this is coming about when we acquire these things. This doesn't come about through our own particular virtues, but this is, in a sense, being an heir to the legacy of the Buddha, because the Buddha had achieved such great spiritual attainments that people in the Buddha's time and through the centuries make these offerings to members of the Sangha because they have respect, veneration for the Buddha. But it was a practice even in the Buddha's time and through the centuries, sometimes people who would have difficulty earning a living out in the world think, how can I live comfortably, have all of my basic material needs met, and not have to worry about my life tomorrow and in the long-range future? Then they think, I should become a monk. If I become a monk, I get a room in a building. I don't have to worry about clothing. People will always offer me robes. Every day I will get enough food. If I get sick, then I get medicine. And so they become monks. I think more monks, usually the nuns, women who become nuns, are more sincere. But those who become monks sometimes do so for the sake of an easy living, a comfortable living. And so if that becomes their whole purpose in living a monastic life, then they're just heirs to material things, not heirs to the Dhamma. But then there are other people who accept the law of karma, the principle of good actions will bring good results in the future, and they undertake the practice of Dharma, not for the sake of getting wisdom, enlightenment, liberation, but they do so because of their belief in the law of karma, that if they do good things now, they will get good results in the future, benefits in the future, worldly benefits. That if they practice giving, it means that they're creating karma that is conducive to gaining wealth in the future. If they abstain from harming others, they're creating karma that will lead to good health and long life. If they make offerings and show respect to the Buddha, to the Sangha, they'll be respected in turn. So this is what's called the indirect sense or the figurative sense of being an heir to material things. That one undertakes wholesome practices, but not for the purpose of enlightenment and liberation, but one does so with worldly aspirations in order to get material benefits. This is very common, and I have to say the truth, in Buddhist countries, that many people do good acts that we would consider good and wholesome, but they do so in the belief that their good actions will come back to them tenfold, a hundredfold. And so they want to get those material benefits by apparently doing acts of self-sacrifice. Okay, so now the Buddha, we come back to the text of the sutta. But maybe at this point I should ask whether there's any questions about this distinction between being an heir to the Dhamma, being an heir of material things. Yes?
I wonder about the last category, the paradise of self-actualization.
Of course, it's not a bad thing. But it's still, in a sense, one does acts of merit. If one does it entirely for the purpose of getting some kind of just a worldly benefit for oneself, it means that one's aim is to become an heir of material things, not an heir of Dhamma. But one can do acts of merit, definitely one should do acts of merit, and just naturally through the working of the law of karmic causation, the acts of merit will bring benefits to oneself, worldly benefits, but one should join the acts, the beneficial, the meritorious deeds, one joins them with the aspiration for a super-worldly attainment, a world-transcending attainment, not just for the purpose of getting worldly benefits. Yes, Eva? Yeah, but that is the case, but it's just mentioned. Actually, technically, I don't want to use this technical distinction, because then I'd have to explain it, but some will understand. It's said to be an heir of the Dhamma in this ultimate sense means that one is the heir of the four paths, the four fruitions, and Nibbana. So they have, these are called the nine world-transcending dharmas. Any further questions on these distinctions? Okay, so then we go on, come back to the sutta, back to paragraph 2. Okay, now the Buddha is giving a kind of consideration in his mind that he relates to his disciples. This is a reason, he's trying to give them a reason why they should try to be heirs in Dhamma, not heirs in material things. He says, if you are my heirs in material things, not my heirs in the Dhamma, then you will be reproached thus. People will say, the teachers, that's the Buddha's disciples, live as his heirs in material things, not as heirs in Dhamma. And I will be reproached in the same way that your disciples live as heirs in material things, not as your heirs in Dhamma. This is somewhat like in a family, people will judge the parents by the behavior of the children. So if the children are wild, rowdy, uncontrolled, when whole family gets together, you know, with uncles, aunts, and if these parents, their children, beat the children of the other relatives, yell, run around the room, tear things up, who do people blame? Who? The parents, right? They say, what kind of mother and father bring up their children like this? They don't even know how to teach the children to be polite, to be quiet, to be friendly with the other children. But they put the blame on the parents. And so the Buddha says that if you just show that you're very worldly, only interested in worldly benefits, of course people are going to blame you, the disciples, but most of the blame is going to come on me. It's the teacher, and saying, can't that teacher? Can't he train his disciples properly? But then the Buddha gives now the counter case. If you are my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things, but not only my heirs in material things, then you won't be blamed by others, and I won't be blamed by others. Rather, it will be said that your disciples live as heirs in Dhamma, not heirs in material things. So then you will be praised in that way, and I will be praised in that way. This is like to give the example of the children when the extended family gets together, and if your children are polite, well-disciplined, they're polite to their elders, they get along well with the other children, and they do everything properly, then people will praise not just the children, but people praise the parents, right? Say, these parents know how to bring up their children properly. Okay, so the Buddha is giving this as a consideration to the disciples, that you should think it's not only your reputation that's at stake, but it's also my reputation that's at stake. So if you want people to respect me as the teacher and to respect our teaching, then you should show yourself, you should behave like those who are heirs in Dhamma or who want to be heirs in Dhamma. Okay, then the Buddha is going to give an example here. It might seem to some something of an extreme example, but it's a rather forceful way to make his case for what it means to be an heir in Dhamma. He takes the case where he's maybe collected food on his alms round, or he's had people offer food to him, and he's finished his meal, and there's still food left over. And then two monks arrive on the scene who probably did not get food that day. And so they're hungry and weak. And then the Buddha tells them that I have this food which I'm finished with. I no longer want to eat it. If you like, you can eat it. But if you do not eat it, then I shall discard it someplace where there's no green grass, or I'll drop it into water. Okay, then one of these monks thinks to himself, he first reflects that the Buddha has this leftover food, and I'm hungry since I didn't get anything to eat today. But now this monk remembers the saying of the Buddha. The Buddha has said, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. And he realizes that this alms food is one type of material thing. So he decides, rather than accepting the food that the Buddha has left over and invited him to take, he decides, let me just pass this day and night, the rest of this day and this night, hungry and weak. He's not going to suffer any serious damage from that, going hungry. Okay, so instead of eating that alms food, he passes it by and he passes the night and day continuing to be hungry and weak. Because the next day he can go on alms round himself and get food, so he won't really suffer from this. But the second monk thinks, okay, there's this alms food that's been left over by the Buddha and he's invited me to eat it. But he doesn't think of that saying, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. And so he takes that alms food, he eats the food, and he rejuvenates himself, regains his strength, and he passes the day and night without any hunger or weakness. But now the Buddha says, even though the second monk passed the day and night neither hungry nor weak, but still the first monk is respected and praised more highly by myself. What is the reason for this? It's not that the Buddha wants his disciples to go hungry. In fact, the Buddha rejected the practice of fasting and extreme asceticism and taught that one should eat enough to sustain one's life and keep one in good health. But the Buddha says that he gives the reason in this sentence, because that act of rejecting the food will conduce for a long time to his fewness of wishes, to his contentment, to his effacement, which means removal of defilements, to being easy to support, and to the arousal of energy. Here there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 qualities are mentioned here. And these are 5 qualities that are considered to be part of the foundation of the Buddhist monastic life, the life of renunciation. One is to have few wishes, not to be overcome by many desires. And so when occasionally one has to go hungry, one can bear that hunger, endure it. That will conduce to having few wishes. It will help one to reduce one's desires. It conduces to contentment. Okay, the monk is content with whatever food he managed to get on his own that day. If he didn't get any, then he just remains content until the next day. It conduces to effacement. That means to removing defilements, because it's a kind of act of renunciation, of relinquishment. It's a factor that leads to being easy to support. This is a pillar of the monastic life, because the monks depend upon donations from others, offerings from others, and so one has to be easy to support, not make demands on people, not request luxurious items to be offered, but to accept whatever comes along and be grateful for whatever support one is given by others. And then this act of relinquishment leads to the arousal of energy, because for one thing, in order to endure that hunger through the day and night, the monk has to be firm and resolute in his will. And also he can use that extra time, since his body is not engaged in digesting the food, he could use that extra time for meditation. Okay, and so then the Buddha, again, he sums up the introductory part of the teaching. He says, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. And then he says that out of compassion for his disciples, he has been thinking, how can I make my disciples heirs in the Dhamma, not in material things? Okay, now when the Buddha spoke that much, then he got up from his seat and he went into his dwelling. And this is something that we occasionally see the Buddha do in the text. He doesn't give a fully elaborate discourse, but he gives a kind of precise or concise and compressed teaching, and then he'll get up and leave. And why does he do that? Often he does that with the thought that after he leaves, one of the other monks will take over the task of expounding and elaborating upon his teaching, because he knows that he has quite knowledgeable monks in the audience who are capable of elaborating on the teaching. And sometimes he'll get up and leave when there isn't such a capable monk sitting in the audience. But in that case, then we see the monks get together and they say, who should we call upon to elaborate upon the teaching? Then they will usually go to either Venerable Mahakachana or Venerable Ananda to ask them to explain the teaching, because those two monks excelled in elaborating upon a brief teaching. Okay, but this time the Venerable Sariputta was sitting in the audience. And so when the Buddha left, then Sariputta realized that he should give a more detailed explanation to the other monks. And Venerable Sariputta takes as the theme of his elaboration the concept of training in seclusion. Here the Pali word is viveka. Okay, the word viveka, or let's say the English word seclusion, usually for us in English, it just suggests the idea of being alone or going into solitude. But the way the word is used in the Buddhist texts, it's given three levels of meaning. So the texts distinguish three types of seclusion. Here the idea of viveka seclusion means separating oneself. So the first is called kaya viveka, which means bodily seclusion. To train in seclusion, one goes off into a situation of solitude or of retreat. One separates oneself from one's ordinary day-to-day activities, busy activities, and goes into a quiet place where one can devote oneself to the training of the mind. Even if one is together with a group of people, but if everybody is practicing meditation on their own, we could say that that's still a condition of kaya viveka, bodily seclusion, since one is not engaged in talking, in busy activities, but one has laid aside social involvements and ordinary activities in order to train oneself. But some kind of separation from one's ordinary routine activities is necessary to fulfill this bodily seclusion. But even though one might be physically separated from activities, but still the mind will be running with thoughts, images, projections. And so the next task in seclusion is called citta viveka. That means the seclusion of the mind, separating the mind from wandering thoughts, from restless thoughts, separating the mind from the five hindrances of sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness, and doubt. And then the third type of seclusion, which in Pali is called upadhi viveka, which means separation from the word upadhi, it's hard to translate. Let us say that this is the ultimate separation from all defilements. Okay, now Sariputta is going to explain the way disciples should train in seclusion. And first he takes the negative case, we're in paragraph 6 now, in which the disciples of a teacher who lives secluded, that's the Buddha, in which the disciples do not train in seclusion. And so Sariputta elaborates this by saying, first, the disciples of the teacher who live secluded do not train in seclusion. And the commentary says, this is referring to bodily seclusion, that they do not separate themselves, go off into solitude to practice. Then they do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. This means that they do not develop mental seclusion. They do not give up the defilements of the mind, or they do not give up the hindrances, the various defilements of the mind in their practice. And then the next statement describes their way of life. They live luxuriously. They're careless and reckless in their behavior. They're leaders in backsliding. It means that they retrogress or regress from the higher goal, and then they neglect seclusion. The commentary tries to relate this statement to the lack of ultimate seclusion. But I have to say, I don't find that identification very convincing in the commentary. Okay, then Sariputta says, in this case, the monks are to be blamed, first the elder monks are to be blamed for three reasons. The three reasons are precisely those three points. One is that they don't train in seclusion. The second is that they don't abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. And the third is that they are luxurious, careless, and so on, neglectful of seclusion. And so the same three reasons for blame come to the elder monks, the middle level monks, and the junior or younger monks. So those are three ways in which the disciples do not train in seclusion. Next, Sariputta explains how the disciples train in seclusion. Okay, here the disciples, they train in seclusion, which means they go off into bodily seclusion. They don't spend all of their time socializing or involved in activities, in busy activities. Then they abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They overcome, they give up the defilements. And in the next part of the sutta, we will come to a list of those defilements. And then the third statement relates to their behavior, that they are not luxurious and careless, but rather they have those qualities that were mentioned by the Buddha earlier, the qualities of fewness of wishes, contentment, effacement, being easy to support and arousing energy. Okay, and then for those three reasons, the older monks, the middle-level monks, and the junior monks are praised for those three reasons. Okay, this takes us up to the end of paragraph 7. Are there any? I'll ask if there's any questions on these paragraphs. Anything unclear? Peter? Yeah, it's actually it was Venerable Sariputta who does that. I have to say, I don't really know. And it it doesn't really add very much to make that distinction. So maybe it's just a way of to drive the point home by applying it to those three levels. That could be the case. At least one would have greater expectation that the elder monks would conduct themselves in accordance with the teaching. And they will serve as a model for the middle level and junior monks. Apart from that, I don't know what rationale there can be behind that. Okay, in the instructions that Sariputta gave to the monks, he spoke about one of these factors of going into seclusion is abandoning what the teacher, what the Buddha tells them to abandon. Okay, now in starting in paragraph 8 and continuing on, he's going to mention the things that should be abandoned and the method for abandoning those things. And he mentions here altogether, it comes out to 16. We call these upakilesas, which means 16 defilements of the mind. So the first two are the most powerful root defilements, greed and hatred. Sariputta says, the evil herein, that is the things that should be abandoned, is greed and hatred. And then for abandoning greed and hatred, there is a middle way. And this middle way, Sariputta says, gives vision or insight. It gives rise to knowledge, and it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And what is that middle way? It's the Noble Eightfold Path. And so the Noble Eightfold Path begins with right view or right understanding. So one begins with an understanding of the basic principles of the Dhamma, and then that leads into right intention, applying one's mind in a way that accords with one's right view, establishing right purposes, right motivations, especially the motivation or purpose of overcoming greed and hatred. Then one practices right speech, right action, and right livelihood by speaking, acting, and earning one's living in a way which doesn't involve increasing greed and hatred. Then one trains the mind through right effort and right mindfulness. Right effort is the energy that one applies to right mindfulness. And then through the interplay of effort and mindfulness, there arises right concentration. And that right concentration is not, though it's the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, but it's not the final end of the path. But this right concentration becomes the basis or foundation for developing insight, wisdom. And it's through wisdom that one eliminates the defilements. And so the middle way gives the vision, the knowledge, the insight that eliminates the defilements of greed and hatred. And so Sariputta then repeats the same thing with other groups. Always there are pairs of defilements, anger and resentment or hostility. Anger is anger that arises occasionally, but when this anger arises directed towards the same person over and over, then it becomes what's called here resentment or hostility. Another pair of defilements, it's translated contempt and insolence. Contempt means when other people have good qualities, instead of appreciating these good qualities, praising them to others, admiring them, one tries in one's own mind to explain them away. Or one doesn't pay any attention to the person's good qualities, but one looks for their faults, just like candidates in the presidential election. If the other candidate has good qualities, they'll never praise the other candidate's good qualities. But if the other candidate has 10 years ago, or maybe in teenage years, smoked marijuana, they'll blow that up. He took a puff of marijuana when he was 18 years old. Or if he has a preacher, religious advisor, who makes incendiary statements, they'll blow that up and say, see, he can't be president. Because his preacher makes some inflammatory statements. Okay, so instead of seeing the good qualities in others, one just fastens on their bad qualities and then one smears them to other people. So that's contempt. Then what's called insolence, it's explained that when other people have done you good favors, have done you favors in the past, benefited you, helped you, then your status improves. Instead of being grateful to them, you look down on them and you take a haughty, arrogant attitude towards them and you disregard their assistance, don't have any gratitude towards them. That is what is called here insolence. Okay, then envy means when other people have good qualities or do good deeds, one becomes envious of their good qualities or envious of their good deeds. And here I think avarice is not such a good translation. What's meant here, macheria, is miserliness. It means when one has wealth oneself, one doesn't want to share the wealth and to use it to help others. If one has some assets oneself, one doesn't want to share and to help use them to help others, but one wants to keep everything for oneself. Okay, then there is deceit and fraud. These are two closely related defilements, but there's a slight difference between them. What's called deceit is explained as presenting to others, let's say, making a show of possessing good qualities that one doesn't really have. We might even translate this hypocrisy. One makes a display of having good qualities that one doesn't really have. And what's called fraud means when one does things that are bad, wrong, blameworthy, one tries to hide them and cover them up. One doesn't open oneself up and present oneself as one really is to others. Okay, obstinacy means being insistent on one's own point of view, insisting on one's own way of doing things, being rigid, inflexible, unyielding. And that's paired with rivalry, which means competing with others, trying to outdo others, to prove oneself better than others. Then conceit means excessive pride, and it is paired with arrogance. Arrogance means looking down at others, thinking that one is better than others, and then despising others. Then vanity means being intoxicated with one's own virtues or one's own assets. For example, they say that young people are vain because of their youth, so they don't show respect and consideration to older people. People who are handsome or beautiful become vain because of their beauty, and then they despise people who are plain-looking or ugly-looking. Or somebody is wealthy, and so they become vain because of their wealth, and they think that they're superior to others because of their wealth. Okay, and then the last one here is called negligence, or this might also be translated heedlessness. This is, in a way, the Buddha says that this is the root of all the defilements of the mind. It means not keeping a close watch upon one's states of mind, one's thoughts, and one's behavior. But one just allows oneself to think whatever thoughts come into the mind, one just yields to any kind of emotions that arise without exercising discipline over one's mind and over one's behavior. Okay, and for all of these, Venerable Sariputta says, the way to abandon them is the same. It's the Noble Eightfold Path. And that is the end of the sutta. Okay, if there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Yeah,
George.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me too as being somewhat of an extreme example. But perhaps the Buddha is using an extreme example there to reinforce the idea of what's meant by being an heir to Dhamma, not an heir of material things. And certainly the Buddha doesn't encourage what one would call extreme asceticism, which is one of the two extremes that the middle way avoids. In fact, it just struck me when you asked that, maybe the middle way is mentioned here, or Sariputta uses the expression middle way in order to correct any tendency that somebody might have to interpret the example of rejecting the Buddha's food as encouraging extreme asceticism. So the real practice of the Dhamma is the Noble Eightfold Path, which avoids the extreme of one extreme is self-indulgence, the other extreme is the self-mortification or excessive asceticism.
I had a similar concern with the food in terms of it would appear that he was encouraging wasting, throwing away, disposing of that which had been donated for the benefit of the Sangha.
Yeah, but...
And again, it occurred maybe it was a metaphorical example to the extreme to teach the lesson.
I think it is to teach, primarily to teach that lesson. But there would be occasions, say, where the Buddha or any other monk, any monk, because they go on alms round and then they collect food in the alms bowl. And sometimes one will collect more than one needs. It's not that one wants to collect a lot, but sometimes people just come along if they see a monk going on alms round and people will put food in the bowl. And so one will collect more than one needs. And what's done at monasteries where I've lived is that when monks come together after going on alms round, then there's tables put out with bowls, then everybody empties what they've received into the bowls, and then each one takes from the large bowls any food that they need. But if one is living alone, then one might have some food left over, and then one will just put it someplace out in the wild. And when one is living in the wild, one doesn't have to worry that food is going to waste. There will always be beings who will be around to collect the food.
Okay, I'm wondering about the relation. I hope that
the third one doesn't come automatically as a result of the other two. Okay, the second type of seclusion, citta viveka, seclusion of mind, is aimed at developing samadhi, that's concentration, making the mind more focused, calmer, more unified and collected. And so when the mind becomes collected, then these defilements don't have any chance to invade the mind and to overpower the mind. But they're still residing deep within the mind at the level of latent tendency. And so to eliminate the defilements, one has to use wisdom or insight. That is what eradicates the defilements. And so the third type of seclusion, that shows the stage that's achieved when all of the defilements have been eradicated, when the mind is completely free from defilements. Yeah. It comes about, but it comes about as a result of something that one does. That is, one has to undertake the training and insight or wisdom. Any further questions? Suki, you usually have questions. Yeah. 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 Okay, mindfulness is just they'll use the word awareness directed to any of the objects of mindfulness. It can be mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of states of mind. But just being mindful of these phenomena doesn't mean that one is actually seeing into their nature. Okay, the insight here is vipassana. So insight means to see the arising and passing away of these phenomena. And then that seeing the arising and passing away means that one is developing the insight first into impermanence. That the phenomena arise, and almost immediately after they arise, they pass away. And so when one is seeing this arising and passing away of bodily and mental phenomena happening very, very quickly, almost instantaneously, then one is gaining the insight into impermanence. And then through the insight into impermanence, one sees that whatever is impermanent is not worth clinging to. If clung to, it will lead to suffering. So that's insight into the characteristic of dukkha. And then one sees also that whatever is impermanent cannot be identified with as being I or mine, myself. That's the insight into non-self. Right, yeah. Any further questions? Okay, if no questions, then we'll stop for the evening. And next time we take sutta number 5 in the Majjhima Nikaya. That's called the Anangana Sutta, without blemishes. Okay, we end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so we share the merits from listening to the Dhamma, teaching the Dhamma. We share the merits with the devas, the deities, the nagas, and other beings, inviting them to rejoice in these merits, to protect the Buddha's teachings, to protect the world, and to protect all beings in the world. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibutim.